I used to think that prayer was kind of a ticket into God, that if I prayed enough, He'd be more pleased with me, and then I would be more of a spiritual person. And then I came to slowly understand that prayer is not about that at all. It's about something far different, far more deep, very much an expression of my heart and my soul, and through an understanding of truth.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
One of the struggles that I've always had when I read my Bible is that it's very difficult for me to understand.
Yes.
I read Jesus' words, for example. I read the parables, or I read the kind of teachable moment times that he has with people, and lots of times I just don't get it. I think if I was perhaps the lawyer who was asking who is my neighbor and Jesus tried to talk to me about that, I think I'd walk away maybe scratching my head and not getting it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever have that experience? Or?
Well, sure. Yeah, the Bible is, everything in the Bible is difficult for one reason or another to understand. There's nothing easy about it, and we kid ourselves if we pretend like it is. It's not.
Well, yeah, I used to think that I ought to just pick it up and read it and be able to get it. And what I did then in trying to just pick it up and read it was, I think, just kind of apply things to my life erroneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or try to interpret it just because I should know it. And it wasn't that it was necessarily accurate, but at least I was telling myself that I was okay, I was smart enough, mm-hmm. I could do this, like it looked like the other people around me could do.
Mm-hmm.
What I've come to realize, though, is that it really is difficult. And to admit that very clearly to myself, and to have to look deeply at passages, and especially before I say I can apply these to my life or see how they look in my life, I really need to understand the passage.
Right. That's right.
And one of those is, we're talking about doing a series on prayer, and one of those is the Lord's Prayer. I always thought, you know, I learned it when I was just a little tyke, and I remember reciting it in the Episcopal church I went to, probably when I was in kindergarten or first grade, but I didn't know what in the world it meant.
Right, right.
Did you have that experience?
Oh, yeah, sure. I recited it for years, not having the foggiest idea what I was saying.
And it is really rich. It's rich, just like the Beatitudes that we were going over not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me it has that same kind of richness if we can only unlock the treasure. Because on the outside, it doesn't look that rich. It doesn't look that big or powerful, or it doesn't look like it has that much depth, when in fact it does.
Yeah. And in fact, I think it has more depth than I actually would be prepared to plumb. It's too bad. We have a colleague, Ron Julian, who studied this, and it would be nice to have him here talking about this rather than me, because I think he'd be more prepared to do that. But
so, Jack, we have to settle with you?
You have to settle for me, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, let's look at the version in Matthew 6. The thing I think, to really understand what's going on here, I think we have to appreciate the fact that what the disciples are asking of Jesus is not this kind of new and unique thing. It was a culturally accepted pedagogical practice. I mean, that as a means of teaching, rabbis typically would compose a prayer that they had their disciples memorize, and the purpose of the prayer was to capture what that rabbi understood to be kind of the essential message that they wanted to leave with their disciples. here's what it's all about. Here's what I think as your rabbi. Here's what I think life is all about. Here's what's central to your existence.
So let's get to the core of the issues.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I'm not sure exactly why they cast it in the form of a prayer, but that was a standard practice, to compose a prayer that would get to the core of the issues of their existence.
So if I was to ask you a question about some kind of theological issue, what you might do as my teacher is compose a prayer to help me understand the issue. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know that I don't know they would do that with respect to any and every question. I think my understanding is they just memorized one prayer that their rabbi composed, because the point of that one prayer was, of all the questions and issues that could be addressed, these are the answers to the important ones.
Okay,
these
so
are the ones that
it was
are central.
Like the teacher's life message.
Yeah, exactly.
And he
yeah.
would distill it down to this prayer.
Right. Now, evidently, not here in the Matthew account, but in the Luke account, I believe Luke has the disciples coming to Jesus and saying, "Lord, teach us to pray as John taught his disciples to pray." So evidently, John had composed a prayer that they had memorized as his disciples.
So they weren't asking about prayer generally speaking, not how do you pray, what's your formula for prayer.
Exactly.
It was more, what is your life message? When you distill it all down to what's most important, what is that?
Yeah, and that makes a huge difference. If you go to the Lord's Prayer thinking that it's about prayer, then you're going to interpret it one way. If you go to it thinking that it's about Jesus, what of all these things you're telling us, what does it boil down to? What is it really all about? Then it casts what he's saying in an entirely different light. So it's really important, I think, to recognize that that's the case. Here, when Luke records it, chapter 11 of Luke, he says, "It happened that while Jesus was praying in a certain place, after he had finished, one of the disciples said to him, 'Lord, teach us to pray just as John also taught his disciples.'" So that's the evidence I'm suggesting that John had done likewise before. And they're saying, "Well, Jesus, you've omitted something. You haven't ever taught us a prayer to memorize. Would you do that?" And so he does. And he gives them what we now know as the Lord's Prayer.
So let me bring that to even more historical basis. Is that a common practice of teachers in that time, not just Bible teachers?
Yes, that's...
Socrates might have done that.
Oh, I see. I think it was strictly Jewish rabbis that had this practice, as I understand it.
Okay. But they held that in common.
You
might find a prayer from many Jewish leaders.
Right. That's my understanding. Yeah. So here in the Matthew account, we have it in a slightly different occasion. Let me start at the first part of chapter 6. "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. When you pray..." So he's been talking about various religious practices or religious behaviors, and prayer is just one in this list. Giving alms was first, now prayer. "When you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners, so that they may be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." Let me stop there for a second. I really understand very well what he's talking about here, because back in my full-blown card-carrying Pharisee days, it was very clear to me that one of the ways that I could make points with other people would be to stand up in my church youth group or in a church service or whatever and wax eloquent in prayer. And I learned the kind of phrases to use that were somehow gave the impression of sincerity and piety and love for God and adoration and so on. I trained myself. I mean, I make it sound so calculating. It came pretty naturally. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't sitting up nights.
You're a natural Pharisee.
Yeah, I was a natural Pharisee. But it was very, even as I look back, even as I was doing it, I was very well aware that I didn't even know what I was talking about. These prayers that I was composing weren't even meaningful to me, let alone were they meaningful to anybody else around me, because I was using vocabulary that relied upon theological concepts that I had never come to understand. Hope, glory, even something like love was not really anything that I thought I knew what love was, but relative to what I understand the Bible means by that now, I was clueless. I didn't know what that meant. So why was I doing it then? Well, I wasn't really doing it for me, and I certainly wasn't doing it for God. I mean, I was doing it for me, not in my relationship with God. I was doing it for me as a show to other people to indicate to them what my spiritual standing was. I'm a righteous person. I'm a good person here. I'm a religious person. I'm a God lover here.
And Jack, would you even take it a step further? Did you not only not know what you were talking about, really, but did you also know that you were trying to make an impression with the way you prayed?
I don't know if I admitted to... I don't know if I would have or could have admitted that to myself, but... yeah, I think I did. I mean, deep down inside, I knew that that's what this was all about. But I didn't pay attention to that. I just plowed ahead and did it anyway. But even in the process of composing the prayers, as I think back about how keenly aware I was of choosing my words according to what's going to sound good. I mean, what is one in this position who's trying to leave this impression? What words do they use?
And so it wasn't really praying in secret at all.
No.
It, as this passage is indicating, it was very much showing off, but kind of in a way that people wouldn't necessarily see it.
I mean, I think this is what Jesus is getting at. If I'd ever stopped to ask myself the question, Jack, would you ever go into your room in private and pray this prayer? The answer would have been no. I mean, I never did.
You know, it makes me kind of laugh.
Yeah, yeah. And what would be the point of that?
Yeah, what would be the... Why? Nobody would hear it.
Exactly. So, I mean, Jesus has just nailed exactly a part of our fallen human psychology here, and what makes us tick, and what's driving us, and what are the lusts and passions that are really making us do what we do in religion. And that, I mean, I relate to it very well, because that's exactly what made me tick.
You know what I'm thinking, Jack? I'm really glad that 30 years ago you and I didn't know each other, because I think we would have had a competition of who could have waxed more eloquent than the other.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah.
And you would have won.
I would have won.
So then he goes on. And when you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. Now, this is a really ironic statement to make when he's just about to teach them the Lord's Prayer, because there has probably been no prayer on the face of the earth recited more times as a meaningless repetition than the Lord's Prayer. I mean, I've been in church experiences where we'll have a kind of spontaneous prayer, and then we'll close it by all reciting the Lord's Prayer together, so that it gets said over and over and over and over again, and as for as many times as I've heard it in my life, you know, it wasn't until I studied it that I actually understood what I was saying, or what it was saying.
That's ironic, isn't it?
Isn't it ironic?
Oh, totally.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Well,
it has become our prayer of meaningless repetition. I mean, right. The quintessential.
Yeah. In Islam, they pray three times a day, and they have prescribed prayers. I mean, you just at this time of the day, you say these words. And that's considered by them to be a religiously meaningful thing to do. We're not quite as regimented as Islam, although some branches of Christianity probably are. But in our kind of low church Protestant Anabaptist traditions that most of us come out of, there's a lot more spontaneity. We believe in a lot more spontaneity. But nonetheless, I grew up with an attitude that what God wants is the activity of prayer out of me. He wants me to be praying. He wants me to be composing sentences that I address to him. I mean, that's really important to God. And I think what he means by do not use meaningless repetitions as the Gentiles do is really more profound than just don't keep saying prayers that don't make any sense to you.
Or don't keep saying the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, he is saying that, but he's saying even something more profound than that, and that is don't have the mindset that God is into prayer for prayer's sake. Don't think that God needs you to tell him what's in your heart, what's in your mind, what your needs are, what the needs of the world are.
Don't just start talking.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly kind of what I thought. If I just kind of spent the time talking to God, that's kind of what he wanted.
Exactly. And yeah, exactly. You've nailed it. That was my attitude, that it was somehow intrinsically valuable if I would start talking to God, that God really delights in me talking to him.
And particularly for me, if I did it early in the morning and kind of did what was difficult, get up early.
Yeah, made a sacrifice to do.
Yeah, and then just spent time. And I remember looking at my watch and thinking, I've really got to stay in this room for at least a half hour because that's what's been prescribed for me. And that's what's godly and that's what's right.
Yeah, because I think I was viewing it as a token that I'm giving to God. I'm making it cost me, God. I want this to be meaningful to you, to you, God. And the way I make it meaningful to you is I make a lot of sacrifices to do it. I spend a substantial amount of time at it so that it's not just a kind of brief, meaningless exercise on my part. I've got to give some substance to this thing so that you know that I'm for you. I love you, God. I'm on your side. And I'm meeting God's needs here, I think is how I perceived it. Now, why do I want to meet his needs? Because I want him to meet my needs. I want him to hear me. I want him to respond to me. Notice what he says here. When you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. That's exactly my attitude. I need God to be responsive to me and give me what I want, but in order to do that, I need to convince him that I love him. I need to convince him that I'm his child. I need to convince him that I'm someone that he should be obligated to.
No, that really looks like that's exactly what it's getting at. Mm-hmm. My intent or my motivation in praying is that God would hear me because I'm praying a lot. I'm doing it. I'm spending a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. And Jesus is just simply saying, don't have that attitude. I mean, he's saying that's a wrong, false attitude. Now, he says that, and from my perspective, most of the theology of prayer that you hear kind of popularly bandied around in Christian culture ignores this entirely. Because much of what we say, and we say to each other, and we teach one another, and the way we exhort each other, is to take an attitude toward prayer that it's a token that we give to God that is meaningful to God somehow. And we sometimes will be as explicit about you can't expect to get anything from God unless you do this for him. Other times we keep that part quiet. But that's really the intent of our heart. I mean, what really drives us is we want God to respond to me. And this is the technique that, this is the currency that God has given us to be able to buy him off. Is through prayer.
And I think there's another side to it, Jack, that maybe this passage could be getting at. When they talked about alms, don't show your alms because it's getting some kind of feedback from other people. Don't show your prayer because it's getting feedback from other people. So it's not just that I want feedback from God, that he would, you know, hear me finally if I pray enough, but I want to get feedback from people in terms of their approval so that I can be seen in a particular way and that I can see myself. So there's three audiences. So I can see myself as a spiritual person. And this is really one of the criteria in our Christian culture that's very prominent.
Right, yeah. So I really think we need to take this verse, this particular exhortation by Jesus, seriously. And if we do, it would revolutionize our whole concept of prayer because he's cutting across so much of current attitudes toward prayer that are just wrong, that are just completely fallacious.
Okay, so I guess the question in most people's minds then would be, okay, well, then are you telling me I'm not supposed to pray? Are you telling me that talking to God isn't a good thing?
Well, no. What I'm saying is, it seems to me that what Jesus is encouraging us to do is to recognize that what God really wants is my heart, not my prayers. What God really wants is my perception and my belief that God is there, that God is involved in my life, that God is the author of my existence, that God is the ultimate benefactor of every gift that I will receive and so on, and then to respond logically, I mean reasonably, to that belief, that I have a heart of gratitude toward God, a heart of dependence, recognize that I owe my very breath to Him, my very life to Him, and so on. That if I am of that mindset, then I am of the mindset that prayer is simply a kind of symbolic articulation of. But somebody can pray and not be of that mindset. I mean, I know, because I've been there. I did that. I was saying thank you to God when I didn't have an ounce of gratitude in my heart. Everything I had, I took for granted. Everything I had, I expected that I had coming to me. I was entitled to. I didn't really have any genuine gratitude in my heart. But boy, did I adopt the tone of voice to
make it appear.
Try to suggest sincere gratitude toward God. Mm-hmm. Well, I wasn't fooling God. I might have been fooling everybody else around me, but I certainly wasn't fooling God. And I think what's behind what Jesus is getting at here is, I mean, this is all about hypocrisy, this whole section we've been reading here. What Jesus is getting at is, God is far more interested that you have some real gratitude in your heart than that you sound grateful through your eloquent prayers that you compose. You know, forget your stupid prayers. Just figure out whether or not you're really grateful to God in your heart. That's what God's really after.
Out of a grateful heart comes a prayer.
Exactly, yeah.
Aren't stupid words anymore.
Right. What I think is that ultimately you can't prevent a human being who really does know God is there and really is grateful. You will not be able to stop us from praying spontaneously in particular situations in response to life circumstances and the things that we see God do, and not just gratitude. I mean, there are other things that are elicited in time of need, a plea to God for help, in time of somebody else's need, an intercession on their behalf. Those are going to come rather naturally and spontaneously, although not nearly so frequently as our mythology about prayer, I think, would suggest. But they will come spontaneously and naturally and authentically and genuinely, because I think there's something about prayer that is just the outgrowth of human psychology, the way God made it. Sometimes we just can't really adequately feel and experience what's really in our heart without it making its way into prayer.
Well, you know, I've noticed that in our church sometimes, Jack, because we don't always pray as much as I would like, because sometimes when somebody will share a need, it'll be deeply felt, and we may not pray for that need at that point. And I have this sense inside of me that says, oh, this needs to be with God. I can't hold this one. This one, we can't solve it. We can't make it better. We can't do anything except for we can bring this to God. And I have this kind of letdown feeling, or this kind of void with, oh, we didn't do it together. We didn't do it as a group. We didn't hold this person up together. And it's that kind of heart, rather than we have a particular time we're supposed to pray and so we do it. Mm-hmm. There's this sense of wanting to.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think that's authentic prayer. Well, I need to back off on that. I don't want to imply that all other prayer is inauthentic. That's the kind of prayer that will be done secretly in your room before God, that's not for other people and is not for any other purpose, but is just spontaneously me relating to my Father, relating to God. A lot of the prayer there's two other kinds of prayers that we see in the Bible. One is what I would call pedagogical prayer, much like what Jesus is doing here in the Lord's Prayer, except that what I have in mind is more the kind of prayer that gets recorded by Paul in the first part of Ephesians, or in Colossians, or in Thessalonians, some other prayers that you see recorded, where Paul says, I am praying that, and then he basically gives them the content of their prayer.
And what he's doing is he's teaching.
He's teaching.
That's what you mean by pedagogical.
Exactly, yeah. Just like Jesus is teaching, he's using the format of the prayer. I mean, I think it's genuine on his part, in the sense that this really is the content of my prayers on your behalf, on the one hand. On the other hand, as he's writing the letter, he's probably not it's probably not a spontaneous movement of his spirit to address God at that point. He's rather teaching them what it is he wants for them.
Or it could be both. It could be a spontaneous movement in his heart.
It could be.
And he's writing it out of that that creative, spontaneous instinct. Like when a writer finally can write, they're saying it with creativity.
Yeah, that's very possible. But I don't think it's required, because I could imagine myself sitting down to write a letter to somebody and say, here's my prayer on your behalf, without, you know, there's nothing in my environment to kind of stimulate a response that I'm responding to, that nothing that has really moved me. But it doesn't change the fact that this really is what I want for them. I mean, this really is authentically my desire on their behalf. And if I cast that in the form of a prayer, there's something about the genre of a prayer that's really meaningful. It really says, really puts an exclamation point on it that wouldn't otherwise be there. And I think that's what Paul is doing in those letters. But, you know, it could be that he's aware of something that he's heard, a report that he's heard, that has really moved him as well. It's hard to say.
But you were saying that there's different kinds of prayer. One is the kind that comes out of our heart. It's a spontaneous expression of gratitude or need or dependence or intercession. They just come out of our heart because we recognize that God is and that he's the author of everything.
Mm-hmm.
The other is, it's very much teaching in nature, mm-hmm. like the Lord's Prayer, which I think we're going to get into at some point today.
Yeah, maybe later.
Maybe later, maybe not. Or perhaps like Paul's prayer in the beginning of Ephesians.
Right.
There's a third kind.
And the third type, and this is what confuses us so much, the third type is liturgical or ritualistic prayer. Because we see the apostles doing that. On the pages of the New Testament, we see people going and praying regularly. But what we fail to recognize there is these were Jews who were practicing their Jewish religion. And Jewish religion then, like Islam today, for example, had prescribed times of the day when you offered up a prescribed prayer of some kind, one kind or another. And that was just part of their routine. That's part of what they did as Jews. That's part of what they did as the people of God who were seeking to honor their God. There's nothing wrong with that. If there's something meaningful about a religion, then the religious practices within that religion are inherently meaningful. They don't need to be spontaneous to be meaningful. They don't need to really be authentic in the way that I've been describing them to be meaningful. They're just part of a whole life that's meaningful. And when you find Peter and John in Acts going to the temple to pray, when they heal the blind man at the gate, you beautiful, are they going in response to some report that they've heard and they're just moved in their spirit and they need to cry out to God? Well, no, because you wouldn't go to the temple for that. The reason they're going to the temple to pray is because that's a part of their religion. That's a part of their religious routine, their ritual. I don't believe ultimately ritual is a necessary part of true spirituality. I think that was the point of Jesus' message to the woman at the well at Samaria. They're arguing about where the right place to worship is, Mount Gerizim or Mount Zion. And Jesus' response to her is, well, the Jews have that right, it's Mount Zion, but the time is coming when those who worship God will worship him in spirit and in truth. Kind of a cryptic statement. It's not
kind of hidden,
obvious.
Kind of hard to understand.
But I think what he means by that is true worship ultimately has nothing to do with worshiping on any mountain anywhere and not engaging in any ritual anywhere. It's not about ritual. It's not about religion. True spirituality ultimately is about the condition of a person's heart, or what he calls spirit. They will worship him in spirit and in truth. It's the quality, the values embedded in the inner man that is going to be the only offering that we offer up to God in the final analysis that is at all meaningful to God. It's having a spirituality that's in touch with truth and that has embraced truth. There is true worship. So I think ultimately, although ritual and religion have played a role at various times in history in the people of God dealing with God, and they may again in the future in the life of the Jewish nation, it's not that they do not have any meaningful role. They do, but it's only for a certain time and place and certain occasion. And the time is going to come where we will all have the wisdom to recognize that true spirituality, the only spirituality that we'll take with us into the eternity, is the spirituality of
what's really in my
heart committed to God.
Yeah. But I want to look at ritual just for another minute, because ritual prayer can come from a person's heart. It can be a reminder of who God is. I remember in my early Episcopalian experience that I think they've gotten rid of the old prayer book, but boy, it was a prayer. They had prayers of humility and suffering. They were pretty incredible as I look back. In fact, a couple of years ago, I brought an old prayer book from a used bookstore and read it, and they're beautiful prayers. They're both teaching in nature, because I think that's the way in which I came to kind of understand that God was big and that God was there. I don't think I learned a lot more than that, but certainly that instructed me to understand that there was more than me around, that in my egotistical world, I had to bust out of it because he was there. Mm. So they were very helpful to me, instructional to me in that way, in the bigger picture. And I'd also think sometimes if I would go into a Catholic church where they do a lot of ritualistic prayer, an Episcopal church, and with my heart leaning toward God as it is in my life today, that sometimes those words could be very meaningful to me in the sense that they would remind me of different ways that God is in the world. It would encourage me to be among other people who are praying also. I wouldn't necessarily know if they were praying from their heart or not, but it kind of takes me away from the mundane, everyday, how do you pay your bills life. Bringing kids to practices and making sure they get to school and going to work and just kind of taking a time out and remembering who God is. In that context, Jack, it can have a whole lot of meaning to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but notice you've described its pedagogical value to you in both those cases, right? I mean, it's not...
It pedagogical, it teaches me, but it also helps me to remember who God is. Maybe that's teaching.
Yeah.
But it's kind of an expression of dependence or just a reminder that this isn't what the world is all about. So I guess that is teaching. Okay,
yeah.
I'll buy it.
Yeah, the thing that I mean, where that cuts across, I think, the kind of mythology of prayer that I grew up with is many people will go on to say, however, that what you're doing there is more than just remembering truths, more than just seeing God for how big he is and all that. It's valuable for that. But more than that, you are entering into a relationship with God there where God will impart grace to you now in a way that if you hadn't been praying that prayer, he's not going to impart grace to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part that I object to, because I think it just doesn't understand what's going on there. God prescribed the ritual prayer to the Jews, I think, for the very reason that you described, because it's this, by entering into the routine, you are routinely being reminded of something that's instructing your spirit. What God is really after is your spirit, not your prayers. But here's a device that he has built into the culture that he has commanded of them to keep and to enter into, that is constantly refreshing the understanding of their spirit of who God is. And yeah, I think it can be very valuable in that regard. What I'm arguing is, but I don't think it goes beyond that. I don't think it, not that that's nothing, I mean, that's important, but we make the mistake of turning it into a kind of a sacrament, of turning it into a kind of technique, a device, a tool that we use to somehow get out of God more of his grace than we would get if we weren't entering into this exercise or this practice.
Right.
I think that's a mistaken notion.
Yeah, we think that God's requiring this of us and that this is what he wants, so that we would show our dependence on him, and that's not it at all.
Right.
You know, I was just thinking as you were talking, Jack, and I hope this relates, is that I was thinking about going into the closet, into the inner room and praying. And I wonder if that is just kind of a metaphor for just kind of going into your heart,
mm-hmm.
just quietly having this heart of the spirit that's leaning toward God. He doesn't necessarily mean go in and do some prescribed prayers or do it for a particular amount of time, but in your inner room, in your heart, have these prayers to God. Out of a heart that's leaning toward God, out of a heart that wants God.
Right, exactly. When he uses that language, I think he probably means literally an inner room, because he's contrasting it with being out on the street corner and in the synagogue and blowing the trumpet.
Kind of showing off.
Yeah, showing off. And so that's his immediate point that he's making there. But I think you're right to see an analogy to that. There's an analogy between going into the inner room where it's not a public show and simply dealing with God in the inner resources of my own heart, not for the sake of the public, but for the sake of my relationship with God. I think that's an apt
And you know, extension. Jack, I think what might be difficult about this is, especially in my early life as a Christian, I didn't know any other way to express my relationship with God. I don't think I had much of a relationship with God. I didn't really know who he was, and so it was really helpful to kind of have this tool of going in and just praying, and it kind of felt like I was doing something.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
And I think it kind of leaves people at loose ends to not have something. But I wonder, I really think that might not be so bad, because then I'm going to have to look further than just a prescribed ritual or a rule of how to get close to God to recognizing something deeper. And what is that? It's what's going on in my spirit? What's going on in my heart? What kind of person am I when I slow down? Am I jealous?
Mm-hmm.
Am I hurtful? Am I even harmful to other people?
Mm-hmm.
Do I have a tendency to want to hold grudges? Or can I work through them to the point that someday I can be forgiving? Those kinds of questions of where is my heart going? Where is my life really headed? Are the questions that we need to ask that get covered up by going through all these rituals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I feel lost.
Yeah.
It's scary.
You feel very lost.
I feel out of control. It's messy.
Because what's required, I can relate to what you're saying very well. That was true of me as well. Where I really felt like I was dealing with God, was doing business with God, is in my prayers. And the rest of the time, I didn't feel like I was doing business with God. It takes eyes to see that God is in the mundane. And that's what's scary, is because, you know, we look at the mundane and it just looks like the mundane. Where's God there? We don't see God there. And because we don't see God there, we carve out this little niche of our life where we step out of the mundane into my prayer life, and there I meet God. But if we stay there, if we don't ultimately see God in the mundane, then we don't see God. Then we're not really ever meeting God. And I think you've described it exactly. The place where I meet God is in the everyday, ordinary moral choices that I make, moment by moment, step by step, second by second, as I reflect on this attitude that I'm going to take toward this grocery clerk who's being so obnoxious in front of me, or this bureaucrat at the DMV, or, you know, we encounter people all the time, and in my encounter with people, something about who I am is going to be reflected. And to the extent that I recognize what's important is that I decide to be the sort of person that my Father, God, wants me to be, I'm meeting God in every one of those moments. It may not feel like it. It may not feel extraordinary. It may not feel supernatural. It may not feel otherworldly. But the truth of the matter is, that's where I am being created. That's where I am being sanctified. That's where I'm being set apart. That's where God is at work in me, branding me with his mark of ownership on my soul, if anywhere. And if not there, then all my spirituality is worthless. If my spirituality is reserved for the time set aside, then it's really ultimately not a very authentic spirituality. And that was true of me. Early in my Christian walk, I had all this piety that I practiced, but it didn't translate into anything in the real world, and therefore was ultimately inauthentic.
Kind of meaningless.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Jack, I was just thinking of an example in my life as you're talking of the spirituality that works itself out in my life and is kind of messy. Last night I was really grumpy, and my daughter wanted to show me something, and she wanted to talk to me, and finally she says, "Mom, are you mad at me?" And I don't even remember what I answered. I might not have even answered, just kind of ignored her. I was not in a good mood last night at all. And I think 20 years ago, I might have gotten up early and prayed to kind of, in a sense, I think, make a little bit of penance for what I had done. Kind of like, oh, man, I really blew it, God. So here, let me put a little bit in my prayer account so that you'll feel better about me. And that's not where my head goes at all today. It more goes to, wow, what kind of a person are you? Look at the way you relate it to your daughter. Ah, I don't want to be that kind of person, and I haven't really thought about it much this morning until right now as we're talking and think, wow, my prayer to God is that He would change my heart to make me a person that would be willing to have the courage to be kind to my daughter even when I'm very tired.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what we're talking about in the mundane. I cannot get this payroll thing right. I have this payroll guy that helps me with payroll. And I think every time he sends me stuff, I mess it up somehow. And this time I send it in to the IRS or whatever, and they send it back and said, you don't have the right forms. So I called in this morning for the upteenth gillionth time, and I could feel this sense of impatience. He said, Christine, did you read the instructions? All you have to do is stick it in the envelopes. And I could hear that, and what I wanted to do, his kind of placating me some and like, oh, how stupid. And in a sense, I think it's so easy and straightforward to him. But what I wanted to do immediately in my heart was to say, that jerk. Well, that's not the kind of response I want at all. What I need to do is understand, it really makes sense that this guy would be a little bit frustrated with me because I'm not following through on instructions very well in it. You know, just kind of understand from his perspective rather than immediately get in defensive and thinking, what place does he have to be this way toward me? Now, regardless of what he should be doing, my heart should be different. And that's a response, a loving response that I need to have. As opposed to having a ritual of prayer, it's much more difficult to be courageous in that way.
Right.
Do you follow me?
Exactly. And that's at the heart, I think, of what Jesus is saying, is when I'm in a situation like that, the thought that comes to mind is, you know, look how I'm being tempted to respond here. Look at my urge to condemn this man and to think of him as a jerk in my heart and so on. And then if I catch myself, the thought is likely to go through my head in a flash, God help me, God forgive me for being that. Well, you know, it took all of less than a second. So I didn't use many words. But I think what Jesus is saying is one of those little brief emails to God is worth hours of you on your knee waxing eloquent to God. That's infinitely more important because I'm facing the truth. I'm becoming wise. I'm, as you say, having the courage to learn to see myself and other people and God and life the way I'm supposed to see it, the way it really is. And I'm having the courage to admit it and have the humility to accept it. That's far more important than acting pious and showing some kind of sentimental love toward God in my eloquent prayers. Those are nothing by comparison. Now, I don't know if you call those prayers, but it really doesn't. I mean, some people might want to call those prayers, but it really doesn't matter because God is not, my point is, God is not after my prayers. He's after my wisdom, my heart, my humility and courage to follow the truth. That's what He really wants from me.
And that's a much harder thing than going for a half an hour or however long and praying. He is asking us to do something that requires courage. It requires humility. It requires looking beyond our egocentric perspective to somebody else, to God beyond us. All of that is far bigger assignment than doing a prescribed kind of number of prayers.
Yeah, I think that's right. But you know what I've noticed is it always seemed hard to pray for an hour to me. And in fact, it seems, as I think about it, it seems harder to me to pray for an hour on my knees. But it's hard for a different reason. The hardness of humility and courage is spiritually hard, is morally hard, mm-hmm. is hard because I'm not that kind of person naturally. And so it cuts across the grain of what comes naturally.
It shows
me
who I am. It's not a pretty picture. And
right.
It's hard to see that over and over and over again.
Right. The other was hard for me, has always been hard for me, for a different reason, and that is because it never made any sense to me. I mean, there was this one part of me the whole time that I was praying for an hour that was saying, why on earth are you doing this? You're praying to the God of the universe who knows everything already anyway, and like you're telling Him something? It just seems so pointless. And what I have finally come to see is the reason it seemed pointless is because ultimately it was pointless. That is, it was pointless from the standpoint of my own assumptions. Because my own assumptions were that God really did want me to inform Him, really did want me to tell Him about my life and so on. I would tell myself, not that He doesn't already know that, but He wants me to tell it to him anyway. Well, now I've come to see, I don't think that's right. I think that's part of the mythology of our theology of prayer, that God is not interested in me in being an informant and telling him what he knows already. That's not what this is all about. And so all of the pointlessness that I felt was true was really a valid response. It really was pointless. And I should have paid more attention to that and learned earlier.
Yeah, should have paid attention. I think another thing that makes that kind of hour of prayer difficult is that it just is hard. In the morning I'd rather have a bigger breakfast or take a, you know, longer walk or be more leisurely at getting ready or study for an exam or get ready for work, or, you know, it kind of plows into right in the middle of what you need to be getting going to in the morning. So that was kind of hard for me. It was just kind of taking the time. And I think there's something valid in taking the time to spend thinking about God. And I really see everything good about stopping my life at whatever time I do it and just paying attention to God in my life or who he is or the direction I should go in, or like examining how I related to my daughter and what I need to do with that and talking to God about that, or to this payroll guy, or that's very valuable, and I don't want to communicate that that's not a good thing. But it's much more difficult to think about those kind of questions than just to sit down and take an hour for an hour.
Right. And for me, it was always take an hour for the sake of an hour that is not meaningful to you, but you've got to do it anyway.
Right, that's it.
I mean, I don't have any trouble at all spending 12 hours a day sometimes studying the Bible. I mean, I love it because it's clear to me that it's paying off, that I'm learning something, that I'm getting somewhere, that it's contributing to my understanding of God and reality and so on. But I don't have the same experience with the kind of prayer warrior type prayer life that people talk about. I don't see the value of it in the same way that I do in Bible study, for example. Now, I don't mean to judge my experience against other people's experience. There may be other people who find some kind of routine of prayer actually spiritually meaningful, and I say then, great, you know, more power to them. But they're no longer doing it just because some theology tells them it has to be done. They're doing it because they see the value in it spiritually, and that's entirely different.
Well, if there truly is value in it spiritually,
right.
They could just be doing it because it kind of eases their conscience or makes them think that God, is hearing them now. Or they could be doing it for hours because they know God's hearing them and they just are falling on their face to God because they believe in him, they want him, their heart calls forward for them to pray in that way. So it's not necessarily one way or the other.
Right, no, I mean, as anything, we can counterfeit anything and hide behind it and use our religion and our piety and our religious practices actually to run away from truth and run away from God rather than toward him. And we always need to be aware of that.
So what I'm thinking, Jack, is that we're almost out of time, and this could actually be so freeing to people. It
could,
really
could be what you say.
Freeing. Uh-huh. I say that a lot about what we talk about here, but it's so freeing not to think, oh man, I haven't prayed in my quiet room for, you know, days or weeks or years, and, you know, maybe I'm not so bad after all, because what I've been doing as I go through life is recognizing God in my life, is having small, short prayers to him that just come out of what's happening inside of me. And that's freeing, rather than feeling like I'm such a failure and God must be so disappointed in me.
Yeah, it would have been freeing to me. I probably spilled more guilt over my prayer life over the course of my life than anything. Hmm. And I think I've mentioned in the past, I use that as a weapon too. I always knew that I could win the spiritual one-upmanship game by making the comments on meeting, I don't think we're praying enough.
Oh yeah, you've told me that.
I mean, you could all, because who's prayed
enough
by our standards?
That's nauseating, because what you were doing was just trying to act like you were praying a lot, acting like you were spiritual, but wasn't there really.
Well, I was admitting that I was guilty too, but somehow I was enlightened enough to know that I wasn't praying enough, but you forgot
that. So that's
that.
Worse.
Yeah.
That's worse, Jack.
Yeah, I know. But the fact of the matter is, by what I would have defined as prayer back then, I pray very seldom today. But I think I'm infinitely more spiritual today than I ever was back then. I'm infinitely more aware of God and my love for God is more authentic, my knowledge of God is more authentic, but I pray very rarely. It only comes out I don't have a routine of prayer at all, and prayer only comes out in those extreme moments where I have no other way to think about God and resolve my gratitude or my praise or my fears or my concerns without falling on my knees and addressing him directly. But mostly my life is spent thinking about God, not praying to him. It is spent reflecting on the truth of who he is and what he's up to and how that relates to how I should live my life. And I'm convinced now that that's where God wants me. That's where I should be. That's not a failure of my spirituality. That's at the essence of what spirituality is, I think.
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
Christine, for a number of months now, we've been trying to let our listeners know where we stand financially and asking them to contribute as they can. We've got lots of feedback that the program has been helpful to people in a number of different ways. But do you know how we stand financially right now?
The small contributions have kind of trickled in. And in terms of larger contributions, I think we've gotten two. We actually got two $8,000 contributions. And the second $8,000 contribution, the people ask that we match the funds. So they will give up to $8,000 dependent on how much is given up to that amount. So it's a possible $16,000 contribution, which is pretty significant. And it's very encouraging.
So any of the listeners out there who are willing to make a contribution to match the funds, they could support us to the tune of another $8,000 then.
Right.
Great.
Which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So thank you for contributing, and we again encourage you to consider contributing if this program has been beneficial to you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 1-800-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.